Hello and welcome to Escape into Storytelling. I'm Jennifer Bradley, and this is a chapter from my self-published novel, Virago. New episodes drop each Monday, and all chapters will be available at the end of the book. As always, there is no charge. Virago is intended for a mature audience, and today's episodes contain language, violence, and death. If you missed last week's episode, it is available from the same podcast source. Now please, sit back and escape into storytelling with me in today's episode. Chapter 32, Murder. On the sun terrace of the Duchess's castle, a sumptuous banquet rested on a white-draped table. The ladies' table members surrounded it, picking at the delicacies, themselves draped in velvets, furs, and fine wools against the chill air. The banquet had been planned for months and went on despite the rioting that was currently boiling in Bristol Square and beyond. Naturally, the talk was of little else. When the gang fight began in Dockside, the table members watched from the terrace balustrade with enormous, fascinated eyes through telescopes and other far-seeing devices. Down below, the orange-lit docks extended into the darkened kedge like fingers from burning hands. A few bright dots on the black plain of water indicated where boats burned. Chamberlain Maine Gordon joined the gawkers at the balustrade. His polite smile hit grinding teeth.
Idiots. They quaff their drinks and make noises to the tune of concerned citizens, but half of them are in Peldon's betting pool. Galbraith has money on Anders wiping out half the Dockside Watch and strangling Bedloe to death. The fucking livelihood of the city is on fire, and they're treating it like street theater.
Thus far, the fire seemed limited to the water's edge. None of the large warehouses, taverns, or rows of shanties, tents, and hovels the Docksiders called home were burning. Small miracles. He emptied his goblet and held out for a refill. His eye fell on a figure slumped in a nearby chair. Lord Dust snored, his mustache rippling gently under his nose.
That's it. I'm done. First thing tomorrow, I'm taking everything out of the counting house and getting the hell out of here. If the goddamn table can't see an avalanche rolling down the mountain at them, I'm not staying here to help.
He bit his lip.
Skinner never said anything about burning the goddamn docks. And Gray, was that Gray's plan all along?
He'd received no messages or visits from Gray in quite some time. It wasn't a relief. People like Gray only stop communicating with you when you're of no more use.
Now I see. The docks are burning, the city's in dire straits, and if anyone knows of my part in it... But what did I do? I spoke to him, I met with Sly Skinner. What part did I play? Does it matter? I'll be seen to be complicit in Skinner's plans, no matter what we met about. Perhaps I should throw myself from the balcony. No, that would leave me in such an untidy state.
The night wore on. Runners came and went, bringing and taking messages. Their reports ranged from the incredulous to the borderline mythical.
Let's see. So far we've had Thaxton dead, Thaxton alive and leading a secret personal army, the captains of the city fighting in the riot, the captains fighting each other, angry Anders dead, Anders alive, Anders killing everyone by himself, Calder saving the day, Calder screwing everything up, and Jabez Figueroa returned from the dead. At least they all agree on one thing. The fighting is done and the fires are out. That we can see for ourselves.
His eyes bleary. He again held his goblet out for a passing servant. Red wine gurgled.
That makes 6, 7 cups? Who cares anymore? I'll drain a keg by myself tonight. Gods know I've earned it. And tomorrow it'll be honey water and oranges in a cheap coach while I set out for my new life.
His eye fell on Josue Farah, the pirate king, who stood talking with Aratzni Plevik. Farah's gigantic magenta hat mushroomed over him, its ostrich plumes nodding in the breeze. He wore black pants and tunic,
a vest adorned with peacock feathers and lapis beads, a sash of dark purple, and a small fortune of gold and jewels at his neck and wrists. He had the right idea. Get taken alive by a genteel enemy and live the rest of your life in comfort. He even gets to make trips around the city. Under guard, of course, but he's not exactly languishing in a cell on bread and water with only rags to his back. Look at those boots! A gift from a bootmaker, I heard. Farrah's feet were encased in glistening sea snake skin, shimmering black with thin white stripes. The low heels tapped smartly as he moved. I wonder which bootmaker it was. I'll ask when he comes by. Oh, he's walking away. Probably needs a piss as badly as I do. Gordon downed the contents of his goblet and followed, unsteadily. Funny. You never imagine he was the Sea King, would you? He's such a dumpy little fellow, practically a potato on legs. I say, this isn't the way to the privy. Gordon found himself following the waddling pirate king halfway through the castle. The unlikely pair wended through shadowed hallways and narrow servant stairs to a darkened gallery 70 feet above the sea cliffs. Jean Plowright and Lady Orswell stood waiting, a rolled rope ladder between them. Gordon's eyes gleamed. Oh, this is too good. This is fucking magnificent. He remained in the shadows, grinning. Your Majesty, the Magister of Plow said, bowing to Farrah. Lady Orswell did the same, her dark braid rippling. Evening, honored members. Lovely night, the old pirate said. He nodded toward dockside. I hope all that noise wasn't for my benefit. Orswell and Plowright glanced at each other, sharing a smile.
I know what that kind of smile means. We have no goddamn clue what's going on, but we're going to nod, look wise, and let you believe whatever you want. Gods, I want to jump out and shout something clever so badly right now.
Farrah rubbed his hands together.
Everything ready?
The Master of Plow nodded.
The wagon will carry you to a cove nearby where a small boat waits. The First Sister sails the moment you're on board.
I'm glad you both saw things my way.
Farrah swept off his hat, handed it to Orswell, and began undoing the fastenings of his vest. Beneath, he wore faded blacks.
I look forward to putting all this behind us.
Divested of his flashes of color, Farrah would have blended into the night but for his brown face and hands. He removed a small jar from his pocket and began to blacken his face with the contents. Plowright touched his forelock.
Give my best to Prince Morrow and all your captains. And remember, the Armisons aren't to be trusted. Just in case you were feeling...
like betraying you and throwing in with them?
Don't think that thought hadn't crossed my mind. I just have better things to do than go to war with nations these days.
Orswell helped him with a bare spot near his eyebrow.
Like what, Your Majesty? Falling asleep on a huge pile of money? Drinking myself stupid every night, eating myself sick every meal. Retirement awaits, my friends.
They helped the king lift the ladder onto the balustrade. It unrolled, the wooden rungs clattering against the stone wall.
This side is shadowed, and they've put out the torches. He can take all night to climb down, and no one would know. They've thought this through very well. Shame I didn't throw in with them. I could have blackmailed them all about this. Oh, what am I saying? I still will. Retirement awaits indeed, my king.
Wouldn't sleeping on money be cold? Orswell asked.
Not if you have enough naked women.
Farrah hefted himself onto the barricade.
Blankets and pillows? Who needs them?
He nodded to each, then lowered himself down with the groan of a person used to soft beds and large meals.
Farewell, lord and lady of the city. Northern Vitral need no longer fear the tax from my fleet.
Orswell tilted her head.
Southern Vitral, on the other hand.
The king winked.
and people called him Sorry King Thorry before. Plowright pretended to frown, and Orswell let out a low, thrilling laugh as the Sea King disappeared into the night. The two conspirators walked away down a hall, speaking in low voices. Their route took them away from Gordon, who leaned back against the wall, smiling.
"Now, I could raise the alarm, catch Plowright and Orswell in the act, and have the palace guard waiting at the bottom of the ladder, but I won't. Oh, I can't wait to see their faces when I tell them, and when I tell them how much it'll cost to keep me quiet. Certainly I have money enough to leave and start over somewhere else, but there's always room for more money."
A breeze off the kedge pushed Gordon's robes around him.
"You know, I think I'll celebrate."
10 minutes later, Chamberlain Maine Gordon nestled among the pillows of the Duchess's study and poured himself a tot of her best red wine. Silk and goose down cushioned his back.
"They can call me a lot of things. Cheap, stubborn, bean counter, social climber, snappy dresser. But they shan't call me a fool."
Gordon chuckled and rolled the red around his mouth.
"Notes of orange, bergamot, cinnamon."
Her ladyship had gone to bed hours before, as was her custom. Most of the palace guard was called out to patrol Westmont and bolster the peacekeeping efforts in Dockside. Something about that nagged at him, but he pushed the thought away and nestled deeper in the pillows.
"I could stay in here for hours and none would know. Probably not all night. I should be careful not to fall asleep."
In all ways, the study was a library. A cavernous room near her ladyship's bedroom, the study was two floors of towering mahogany bookcases and iron ladders. Black and white Worosan marble mirrored the design of the Academy's library, complete with alcoves containing low tables, lush rugs, and pillows for sitting on the floor in the Worosan style. He took in the vaulted ceilings, dark wood furniture, brightly colored carpets, and huge fireplace.
"Some of her edicts and resolutions were dreamt up right here in this room. The history of Glendale, of Northern Vitral, was written in here. Even all of Vitral, if you think about it, since Paradis and Morden used so many of her ideas in their own policies."
He inhaled, noting the absence of dust and nodding in approval.
"They rotate the books and fluff the pillows every day, as if she might suddenly toddle in here and pick up where she left off. I suppose I can see why. We all hope she'll keep going forever, that she's secretly immortal. She's everyone's beloved grandmother."
He frowned, swirling his glass.
"I should be celebrating, not maudlin. Tomorrow is full of promise, especially the promise of blackmailing Plowright and Orswell. At long, long last, I have something juicy on both of them at once."
No lights burned in the study, but moonlight poured in through high windows. Torches burned in the hallway, lending enough dancing gold light to let him see.
"Not a more perfect place to celebrate..."
Footsteps. His hazy eyes widened. The steps sounded far away, behind a door. They were slow, tired.
"A servant?"
A frisson ran down his back.
"No, not at this hour, unless something's happened. I should find out, but no sense being seen in here."
Gordon slipped his shoes off, stood, and crept across the study's carpeted floor. He huddled unseen in the shadow of the archway. The circular antechamber beyond was 50 feet across. Torches lit the walls, and a round, solid oak table stood in the center. There was a main door to his left, and another on his right leading to her ladyship's bedchambers. He stared at the door leading to her grace's bedroom and frowned. The steps were closer, but he couldn't tell from which direction they came. A chill ran through him.
"That's what was bothering me. The alcoves are empty. There should be guards in there. I shouldn't have made it this far. They called out the palace guard to assist in securing the city, but there should still be someone there."
On his left, a main door burst open. Victor Woodburn hurried across the room, as if his life depended on it, with his customary silence.
"Gods, he scared the hell out of me. Good thing I took my shoes off, and I'm on the eye patch side."
The door to the Tuchess's bedroom opened with a click of a latch. Victor's little clerk stepped through.
"What the hell is he doing in there?"
The clerk was cleaning something. A crumpled rag moved back and forth in his hands. There were bags under his eyes, and his was the heavy tread that Gordon heard. The clerk saw Victor and started. Victor froze. All the energy thrumming through him bled out. His eye moved to the clerk's hands and then up to the man's face.
"He doesn't look surprised."
Victor tilted his head at the clerk.
"Did you hurt her?"
"No more than I needed to."
All trace of the clerk's accent was gone. The rag moved away, revealing a long, wicked blade. Maroon stains covered the rag as the clerk tossed it to the floor.
"She didn't suffer. She saw the blade and died of fright. I cut her throat after. It still had to look like a murder, of course. Her servants, though..."
"Oh, gods!" Gordon's hand crept over his mouth. "Do not move, do not breathe, do not do anything to let them know you're here." Victor lowered his head. The clerk shifted his stance, preparing for an attack. The blade turned toward the huntsman, gleaming in the light. A second figure stepped through the door behind the clerk. Bloody to the elbows, the newcomer was tall, with broad shoulders and long, muscled limbs. His head was shaved, and tattoos crawled from beneath his sleeves.
"The Swordmaster, the one who ran the fighting exhibition at Edgewater and spearheaded the new training program. He was the new lieutenant in Dockside, the one under Bedloe."
"Good evening, my lord,"
the newcomer remarked, speaking in Gray's musical voice.
"You seem surprised."
Of all the things Victor seems right now, surprised is not one of them.
"Scaring her to death."
Victor's fists clenched.
"You could have used poison. She could have slept through it, damn you."
The clerk sighed.
"It was an assassination. It has to look like one," he said, gesturing with the blade. "It had to be gruesome. You of all people should know that."
"She was over 100 years old. The king could have waited."
Gray circled the room, keeping close to the wall. He wore a sword, but Nate made no move to draw it. The clerk ran a hand over his shorn head.
"The king was tired of waiting. His grandfather put her in power, and his father regretted it. You know how little patience His Majesty has, and what he's capable of. Did you really think him above murdering an old woman, even if she was a duchess?"
He tilted his head at the main door.
"Or a duke. You must realize I was on my way to Alistair's room next."
Gray came to rest by the exit, about 20 feet behind Victor. He still had not drawn his weapon. Victor paid Gray no mind, glaring at the former clerk.
"There is no next. You aren't leaving this room alive."
A half-smile hitched the clerk's mouth. He folded his arms, the blade sticking out beneath his elbow.
"Come now. I've served you for 3 years. I know your every move, every trick."
He inclined his head, smiling.
"It doesn't have to end this way. The king respects you. Glendale is just one city in one country. Your mistress is dead. You're a free agent now. You can do as you like."
Victor reached up. Both men reacted, the clerk tensed, arms unfolding and eyes narrowing, and Gray's hand went to his sword grip. With quick movements of white fingers, Victor removed the eye patch and set it on the table. A twisted gray scar spanned the hollow under his eyebrow.
"So you know my every move. I wonder if you can tell me what I'm going to do next."
There was a hiss as Gray drew his sword. He shifted his weight to one leg.
The clerk's eyes flicked over the spymaster. You have two blades hidden in your boots. The boots were removed, slowly. Their supple leather did not creak.
They'll rush him while he's balanced on one leg.
Gray remained where he was, his fingers flexing on the sword grip. The sword tip hung in the air before him, 20 feet of air between its gleaming point and Victor's back. After what felt like a season, the huntsman's bare white feet glowed in the candlelight. You have a poison ampoule in your shirt, a small glass one, sewn into your left sleeve cuff. There was a tiny, brittle sound as the glass bead was set down on the table next to the eye patch. The clerk looked him up and down. The shirt can be used to strangle a man if it's damp, but please don't feel as if you need to. The huntsman lifted his tunic over his head. It fell to the floor in a whisper of silk. The pants came last, the long muscles in Victor's thighs flexing as he balanced on one leg, then the other. Underneath, his pale skin was a patchwork of gray scars. They twisted along his arms, his stomach, and one thigh. His chest and back puckered with them.
He's so small. All this time he's been barely 5.5 feet tall, and I just never noticed. And his boots have no heels. How did he seem bigger? And those scars on his back. Whip marks.
Is it to be this way? How very primal. The clerk glanced at the swordmaster. I'm game if you are, Itrigar. When's the last time you fought naked? The swordmaster said nothing. His attention remained riveted on the spymaster. The clerk's gaze shifted. Do you really want them to find you this way? Her and there, everyone gutted, and you out here naked? What will they say? Nothing they don't already, I suppose. Victor raised his arms and displayed his hands. A sharp half-smile of his own was aimed at the clerk.
Well, you've made your point, whatever you...
A tremor ran through the huntsman's body.
Grisla, he's taken some,
Gray observed. From where he stood, he could only see the man's body trembling and contorting.
What's wrong with him? What's happened?
Gordon's eyes bulged. His nails sank into his cheeks as his hands sealed up a scream. Victor's breathing became hollow and gusty as his chest changed shape and expanded. The rumbling filled the room. He bent forward from the waist, reaching out, and when his hands touched the marble floor, they were claw-tipped paws.
A wolf? But it's huge!
The creature stood in the room, its black fur shining in the torchlight, an eye like a single moon fixed on the clerk as it lowered its head. A few breaths were all it took for the small man to change into the enormous black beast. The clerk's hand still clutched the dagger, but it might as well have been several hundred miles away. His arms dangled at his sides, and his mouth hung open. Gray's sword point rested on the floor. His chin rested on his chest.
Well, Aaron, nothing more to say.
The voice echoed in Gordon's mind. His hand tightened over his mouth, and his other had crept up to clutch at his chest. A hot trickle ran down his cheek. Gray raised his blade. Aaron blinked.
Help! Murder! Lord Woodburn has murdered the Duchess!
Behind you!
The beast spun, meeting Gray's lunge. A huge paw knocked the blade aside, and the head dipped, seizing Gray's outflung arm. There was a terrific crack, a wet ripping sound, and the arm was flung away, the sword clanging on the floor in the still tight fist. Gray turned white. Red jets sprayed from his shoulder as he turned and stared at his detached arm. When the jaws closed around his head, he made no sign he noticed. Ripped free, the head was flung and landed next to the arm. The man called Aaron was gone. In the few seconds Victor had taken to destroy Gray, the little clerk had darted around the two combatants and disappeared through the main doorway.
He heard me. I know he did.
The wolf grunted. It glanced back at the Duchess's bedroom door and made a thin sound. When it turned, a dagger hilt's outline was visible against the torchlight, buried in the beast's shoulder. Shaggy black pelt melted away to white, scar-mottled skin. Breathing heavily, Victor stood up. He glanced at the wound on his shoulder, reached up, and touched the hilt. He took a breath, wrapped his fist around the handle, and yanked it free, air hissing between his teeth. It clattered to the floor as he reached for his clothes. Redressed, he staggered to the Duchess's bedroom, holding his shoulder shut. Gordon counted 5 heartbeats before he heard a muffled cry.
"He'll come back in here. He'll come back in here, and I better have a damn good story ready."
Voices echoed in the hallway outside.
"Tell you I did hear something."
"Alistair, thank the gods."
The door creaked open, and Alistair entered with several other table members in tow.
"Plowright and Orswell? Gods, how long have I been up here? It feels like years, but it must have only been an hour."
"Where are the gods?"
Tribule broke off at the sight of the bloody, crumpled mess of the assassin's body. He and the others clustered around the carcass, exclaiming in wonder. They stood with their backs to the study door.
"Now! Go now, past the table, just behind Galbraith. Look suitably shocked."
Gordon arranged his features into a mask of consternation as he folded into the little group, pretending he'd been there all along. One hand slipped into his pocket, and the other covered his mouth.
"Mother?"
Tribule turned toward the open doorway.
"Mother?"
This concludes Chapter 32 of Virago. Stay tuned for the next episode, Chapter 33, in which the ladies' table attempts to make sense of the senseless, and Adelaide is called before them. If you want to read along, Virago will be available in abridged print or ebook format from Amazon October 1st. If you enjoyed this work, please remember to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss an episode of Escape into Storytelling. Thank you for supporting independent and self-published authors like me. Until next time, be seeing you.